Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Wake up, San Francisco. I'm Danny Tanner. Welcome to the show today. Happy New Week, everybody. Jake Reiner, we're going to be talking about the Reiner situation here. First, your thoughts. We'd love for you to weigh in out there on the comment section. Jake Reiner wrote about waking up every morning and having to convince himself it wasn't a dream. He put out a new a piece this week. It's the first time he's spoken publicly on his Substack. The article is just called Mom and Dad. He wrote about being robbed of his parents at his wedding, of grandchildren they'll never hold. Meanwhile, reports say the brother accused of taking all of that from him is allegedly plotting a revenge tell-all from his jail cell, not to seek justice, not to take responsibility, but reportedly to settle scores with the very people who spent years trying to save him. So when a family pours everything into someone dangerous and loses everything because of it, at what point does the person left standing get to stop carrying the weight of someone else's destruction? That is what we are getting into in our first segment this morning. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, my co-host with us as always. Good morning.
Yeah. Happy Monday. What a busy weekend.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh. With everything going on, with everything we're covering. And then in between all that, the assassination attempt and everything. You know, Tony and I are going back and forth watching more of our cult specials on TV, too. Yeah.
It all comes up to, I mean, everything just comes down to really unhealthy minds. That's where we end up with everybody.
Well, at the same time, though, it helps you appreciate what you do have. Every time you watch and absorb and digest what's going on in the world around you, it gives you context to see what is healthy and what's unhealthy, so you know what to attach yourself with, who to interact with, and know what to tolerate or not tolerate in your life. I think that's one of the greatest things about doing what we do is we give some recognition for everyone tuning in to what's right and what's not right when it comes to who should we have in our lives and what we should do about it.
Yeah, 1,000%. We're taking your questions on Substack, YouTube, Facebook, X, wherever you're watching us live. We also have several of your questions that you've dropped on our videos over the last week or two. We're going to try and get to a handful of those here as we work through this live today. But please do drop them. All right, let's just start with this one, the first one. It's something I think a lot of people have thought about when they've looked at this case. It says, I keep thinking about that smirk at the arraignment, speaking about Nick Reiner when he was in court. This is at you, Robin. You study people for a living. What does a guy who reportedly can't process why he's in jail but still wants to write a revenge book actually look like from a behavioral standpoint? Because those two things don't go together in my head. Danielle on Instagram asks that question.
I keep things as simple as possible in all this. I'm not the lawyer. I'm not licensed psychotherapist like our great Siobhan is. So I just break it down into this. That is one broken brain.
Yum.
It really comes down to that. It is a sick MF-er. It really is. And I don't think there's any fix in it. And I know this comes up with one of the questions later. Medications that they kept trying with him and are continue to try with him are Band-Aids for the underlying broken brain. It is an unfixable brain in that head. And so I just think it comes down to that. There is no reasoning with it. There's no having it shift. We haven't seen it yet. Why would we see a shift in his behavior pattern? Remember, past is prologue with a lot of people. And even though we all learn and we're not the same people today as we were yesterday, you can kind of see those arcs, those trajectories. That's why I always go to behavior arcs and life arcs of people, because people are not going to have these major shifts out of that unless there's some event that they have this aha epiphany. Mm-hmm. And even with an aha epiphany, that rudder starts shifting slightly. It's not like, today I'm a horrible human being that is a wound-collecting, victimizing person with a broken brain, to tomorrow I have this epiphany. And in other words, it's not a Scrooge moment from Christmas Carol where he has three dreams in the middle of the night and wakes up fixed in the morning. It doesn't happen.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen for many people ever.
It needs to, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great if, like, that story actually worked out and people learned from their horrible mistakes of being massive narcissists their whole life, and suddenly they wake up one morning and like, I'm better.
It's a fascinating thing, too. So we can look at patterns of behavior across society, across everything, to really understand what we can reasonably expect in every situation. Does anyone watching, listening, tuning in, does anyone ever know someone in their life that went from 0 to 100, went from completely broken to the next day they woke up full accountability and fixed? The closest you'll come is to like a drug addict, alcoholic, or something like that, that has their rock bottom. Mm-hmm. And they make the decision that they are broken and they're going to save their own lives by going to meetings, getting clean, going to detox. And then the rudder shifts and they stop consuming the horrible things that are destroying them, and they start the first step on their journey to come out of it. And it doesn't go from 0 to, oh, I get it. It goes from 0 to the first step, the second step, and it's days, weeks, months, and years to crawl yourself up out of that mess you created yourself into being a functioning, more healthy human being that can have a reasonable expectation of a great relationship with another human being. But for Nick Reiner, ain't happening. I mean, how many times has he hit rock bottom only to be saved and coddled by others?
Well, I guess maybe that is the question I think that some people have is has he ever really truly hit rock bottom? I mean, there are stories where he was homeless. He's talked about it, but they aren't like, there are not stretches of homelessness, I think, that a lot of people who are homeless experience. Like, he always kind of had a safety net to kind of go back on. It's like homeless light. Tried it out for a little bit, was like, this is a bit much for me, and then wandered back to the shelter of his parents and those who could essentially keep him from ever hitting rock bottom. And drugs were involved in much of Nick Reiner's existence. What's scariest to me about people like Nick Reiner and people not like Nick Reiner but still have the same sort of pathology and all that is the folks with the drug addiction and things of that nature. Sometimes, like you were saying, if they can get themselves cleaned up, if they can get on a good path, There can be some paths to redemption. Hmm. What's more scary, the folks where drugs are not involved at all, and this is just how they are. because you remove some of that and the weight that the drugs are having on the brain, and like suddenly things can clear up a bit. When it's like this is just your normal mode of thinking all the time, that's even scarier. And I feel like obviously drugs are a big part of the story with Nick Reiner, but I think even you take the drugs out of the equation with Nick Reiner, because there were moments of sobriety here, and he was still a very broken person, and still very much someone who didn't seem to ever truly take the accountability for his actions.
He's in isolation, eating crappy food, in jail, no drugs involved anymore.
True.
And
plotting.
And he's still the victim in his own mind. No account. I mean, you don't, what other bottom can you hit except death? You know, I think he's addicted to bouncing on the bottom. He just loves dwelling there. He loves, I mean, think about this. Besides that broken brain, which I think is unfixable because of people, they paid a lot of money and try to fix it, ain't fixed yet. Mm-hmm. Why else continue? He's addicted to being the victim. He loves it. He's thriving in it. Otherwise, why would you continue it unless you're incapable of moving out of it because your brain is so chemical imbalances, malformations, whatever it is up there that, you know, people like Siobhan love to diagnose and can diagnose much more effectively. But again, if they could diagnose it so well, they would have fixed it or made attempts to fix it and it just hasn't worked. Who knows? But it ain't working.
I mean, recognizing the problem doesn't mean you're fixing the problem. You know, you can go, there's a giant hole in the side of the Titanic and it's sinking. Well, if we got it into dry dock, we could cover that up with new metal and make it float. It's already sinking. It's in the middle of the ocean. Just knowing that is what would be the fix doesn't mean you can implement it. And I think that's very true with some people, including Nick Reiner. Another question we have here. Jake said he'd trade. This is Jake Reiner, Nick's brother, said he'd trade every Dodger game and every Broadway show just to talk to his parents one more hour. In that, and I highly recommend reading it on Substack. I restacked his post so you can find it on ours. The link is in the description for Substack. It's a really, heartfelt piece about his parents. So he's talking about all those memories and everything that he shared with them. How do you even begin to grieve people you lost to violence when the person who allegedly took them is your own brother? And he's still finding ways to hurt you from inside the cell. That's a question from Rachel on Facebook.
Yeah, I don't know. I think everyone does it differently. To me, I mean, and I've seen this in other cases, and I think I would do it in my own life. You just have to cut him off. I mean, he's not as, that's not your brother. That's something inhuman in there. It's just, I don't know how it looks like he was this way a very long time, but that's not your brother. That's not a human being. That's someone, it's something that is a toxic cancer in your life. And you just have to treat it like that. You've got to cut it out. You know, some people, and we see this with the cults. We saw it with Amy Duggar when we interviewed her and other family members. We want to give a lot of grace to family, but I always ask myself, why? Seriously, you can really see some really unhealthy, toxic things. And if you keep associating with it, again, there's a choice. It's not right or wrong or better or worse. I can just tell you the impact if you keep associating with it or keep allowing it to infect your brain. And I didn't say infect your brain because that's exactly what it's taking up, that gray matter. It's taking up bandwidth. It's taking up space. You know, if you just regard it as a broken tool that is no longer servicing me, you got to cut it out. Because I tell you what, he's not viewing him as his brother. He's not viewing him as anything but a tool that he can try to manipulate for his own gain, for his own pleasure. Because the only pleasure Nick Reiner is getting, again, pure conjecture at this point, is continuing to inflict pain and discomfort on others. Because what has he done his entire life? Inflict pain and discomfort on others. He seems to enjoy it. Otherwise, he wouldn't do it anymore. Why is he getting it? Broken brain, whatever. But it's... We allow people to infect us when we accept them still in our lives. Just cut that crap out, man. And I'm sorry for them hugely. And I know it's tough for family members, people to do that. But if you keep accepting unhealthy in your life, it's going to be painful. Unless you have the ability to at least sit back and, as I say multiple times a day, watch a show. I can be very close to people, close proximity. I can listen to words. I can have great conversations. But because I assess who they are, what they stand for, and all these myriad of things, their words don't have impact on me because that's their thoughts, their beliefs, their position in life, and it'll just roll right over me like water. No, but now if someone I do feel close to, I mean, like you, Tony, Todd, our crew here, my wife, my family, my kids, what they say, what their opinion matters very deeply to me. I cannot actually take an action in my life without one of these close people in my life being part of it. Mm-hmm. And if you're part of my very tight circle, it's tight. And there's a huge bar of good, healthy relationships that you have to meet to be there. But other than that, I enjoy the show. People got great words. Some have horrible words. I take it all in, assess it, and then it rolls right over like water. Hard to do. Takes a lot of reps. But in order to preserve yourself, because you can't be there for others if you allow people like that to infect your life.
Do you think the no, and this is me, the we're in an interesting place right now in the span of human history. The whole no contact thing with your family wasn't even, just 20, 30 years ago. It was like, what? Oh, my God, who would do that? And if you go further back, you can kind of understand why people weren't doing that. It was out of necessity. It was more so like survival. It didn't matter if you had some narcissistic asshole person in your family. If you needed them to survive, you needed them to survive. And you had to figure out a way to make everybody, all the cogs in the wheel work together, even if some weren't. We're not in a world like that anymore. We don't need all the cogs in this wheel to function, to survive. If you have a family member that's just a bad apple or whatever you want to call them, flat out evil, you don't need them. You don't have to keep absorbing them. But I don't know that we've mentally caught up to that reality yet. I feel like we're getting there. I think it's interesting. Oprah just did a piece on this, a multi piece on this, about families going no contact and what that means and why people are doing that. Because there's a huge percentage of people that are doing it far more than ever have in the past with family members that have been toxic. People that have decided to stop accepting unhealthy.
Yeah.
Is this just something? Do you think we're going to get better at this as time goes on? Because it's not required, and we're not. I think a lot of people stay by unhealthy out of shame, and by out of guilt. But guilt and shame that are, I think, very much misplaced, that aren't necessarily accurate to the situation. But because we're told we should feel guilty or shameful for telling an unhealthy family member to go away and go over there. I feel like that dynamic is shifting.
I do too, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah.
We are genetically and biologically coded for group tribal mentality. It's part, like you said, it's part of our survival. Ancient tribal man, if you didn't belong to the close-knit society, close-knit group, close-knit family, the chances of you being able to procreate and pass on your genetic coding was slim to none. Mm-hmm. So we're coded to want to unconditionally accept and believe in and be around that close family structure. But to your point, because society is so evolved with community, with government, with businesses, with organizations, the mechanisms for survival are in place outside of family. Now, family is a great thing to have if it's healthy. What I really like about this is that, and Amy Duggar talked about it when we chatted with her,
yeah,
it's breaking the toxic cycle. It's breaking the cycle internally of the trauma response family that's constantly, because I don't know the percentage, it's very high. I think it's 85 to 95% of child S abusers come from a place where they were introduced to it at a young age, either by a family member or someone close to that family. So that's where you break the trauma cycle. When you break that trauma cycle with healthy relationships, you have to distance yourself from that original family. And then what are you doing? You're aligning with new family. You're aligning with a new spouse, with a healthier spouse. And so then you can recollect the family, and then family can be close again because you broke the trauma cycle. Yeah. So I think it's taking families that were broken for generational trauma, breaking it, because it takes courage, it takes strength, and it takes a lot of effort and bravery to have the courage to break that trauma cycle, that generational trauma cycle, and then start a new cycle with a new family. And then we can actually go back to this. So those great, wonderful family values will allow us to do what? Feel safe, feel seen, feel heard, and be valued by others. But when you're in that toxic generational cycle, it doesn't happen. And I think that's what people are starting to do. They're starting to have the courage because, you know, as detrimental as social media can be and all this online stuff we have, at the same time, it's able to get messages out like the people like the Jill Duggars and the Amy Duggar Kings that were able to escape the trauma cycles, and you know, and people that are able to escape FDLS, and even in this situation, brothers that are able to break from toxic other brothers that have destroyed families, that have murdered their parents, you know, break that cycle, get out, move on. And I think that's what's going to be hopefully a resurgence using what could be negative and use it for positive.
I agree. I think that is, it's a very healthy way of looking at things in a way that essentially has been shunned, I think, in society for a long time. You don't think that way. That you don't even entertain this idea.
Right.
When in reality, that's the way to freedom, if
don't
you want.
Don't do crazy.
You know? Yeah.
Just don't do crazy.
Just don't do crazy. Make that your policy in life. Don't do crazy. Keep them out. And don't be afraid to say, no, I'm done. I mean, it feels like a lot of life almost, I don't know, in some ways of looking at it, some generations, it's almost like, how long have you known these people? Life is not a race, and it's not a contest of how long have you had certain people in your life, because at the end of the day, there's no prize for having toxic people in your life until you're dead. You're going to be much more happier by the time death comes if you had exchanged some of those toxic people for healthy people. There's only so much bandwidth you have to give and take out there. Why not spend it with healthy people, not the unhealthy?
So I'm going to give everyone, and I've read, I can't remember what exact book that I read this. I read so many books, but here is exactly the win for life. If you want to, everyone is pursuing a successful life, a happy life. And it's easy to get caught up in the materialism of the world and have someone else define for you what success is, with monetary gain, prestige, title, accolades, all the things that you didn't come into the world with and you're not leaving with. Mm-hmm. So how do you cannot measure success by those things. There's only really one thing alone I believe you can measure success in, and that is how you're remembered, the type of person you are. Do you want to be remembered as this great professional, or you want to be remembered as someone that lit up a room when you came around that corner, that's always there for someone else? And most importantly, the greatest gift you can give yourself and give others, the only thing you'll leave, is what you taught others about how to treat others, how to be present for them, how to be kind, how to have grace, how to do all these things that help others have healthy, strong relationships. That is what success is. That's what the life win is. What are you going to do to inspire other people to live a healthier life so they can pass it on generationally to the people in their lives? That is what's going to move, that's what's going to move our species forward beyond what it is now, with constantly this. Mm-hmm. And why is it this? Because we are constantly caught up in these toxic things. It doesn't matter. You can't mm-hmm. take any of this crap with you. So focus on those relationships. Be that beacon that people want to gravitate to, and then to pass on those skills to those that matter in your life, and those new family structures form around. There, I'm done my soapbox for the day, right?
So if you don't want more of this, get more of that. Buy this book right here. You like that transition right there?
Yes.
Wasn't that fun?
And see, it's not all about me.
Exactly. It's Robin's latest book, and it's available wherever books are sold. Go and check that out.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Jake Reiner recently broke his silence 4 months after his parents were found deceased in their Brentwood home. The eldest son of Robin Michelle Reiner sat down and he wrote something that wasn't a press release. It wasn't a legal statement. It wasn't a strategic move. It was a Substack essay, actually, titled Mom and Dad. And in it, he said, what anyone living inside this kind of grief would say if they were brave enough to put it on paper. He said he still wakes up every morning trying to convince himself it wasn't a dream. He called it his living nightmare. He wrote about being robbed of his parents at his wedding, of them holding a future grandchild, of them watching him build the career he's still chasing. He said it simultaneously breaks his heart and enrages him. That's one brother. The other brother, the one of creating, accused of creating that nightmare, innocent until proven guilty, in my opinion, alleged, put that in front of everything going forward, is reportedly doing something very different from inside Twin Towers Correctional Facility. To insiders cited by Globe magazine, Nick Reiner is allegedly planning a revenge tell-all. Not a legal defense, not an apology, allegedly not a reckoning with what he's accused of doing. No, a tell-all. One designed, according to those sources, to lift the lid on what he calls his parents' sordid secrets, to name as many names as possible, and to cause as much embarrassment as he can to the people who reportedly stopped answering his calls. Now, look, there's a lot of people in Hollywood that certainly deserve tell-alls done on them. I don't know that Rob Reiner is one of them. I don't know that there's a sordid story behind the headlines here, other than a malignant, mentally ill narcissist, possibly psychopath, that sees a way to fund his defense by making a lot of shit up. And as we go through this, give me your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. One brother mourns, the other allegedly schemes. And the distance between those two responses is the entire map of how this family was torn apart. To understand why the reported tell-all matters, not as gossip, but as a window into what's really happening inside Nick Reiner's mind, you have to understand the sequence of events that led to this moment. After his arrest on December 14th of 25, Nick initially retained high-profile defense attorney Alan Jackson. Yes, Alan Jackson from the Karen Reed trial. Seems like the kind of hire a family with resources might make. But January, right after they hired him, Jackson withdrew from the case, citing circumstances beyond his or Nick's control that made it impossible to continue. Before walking away, Jackson made a pointed public statement that under California law, Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder. That's what Alan Jackson said in his moment on the court steps as he spews a lot of shit. Now remember, Alan Jackson, he's a defense attorney. We could probably find a lot of statements Alan Jackson has made on court steps that turn out to be not exactly in line with reality. But again, that's a defense attorney. It's not a comment on any case or this or that. I'm saying it's kind of their job. Vigorously defending their client. Even though he wasn't his client at that moment in time, he was still coming through as a defense attorney. I'm not faulting him that. I'm just telling you what that is when we're looking at it. It's not necessarily a statement of fact. It's an opinion by a defense attorney on a courthouse step. It looks dramatic. It looks exciting. It looks like, wow! If you're not one who tends to review material or look things up or do research or double check things, and you just take things at face value, I'm sure that's a powerful statement. And it may be right, technically. It may, I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong either, because under California law, if Nick Reiner is in fact guilty of murder, which it sure as hell seems like he is, in my opinion, even if he did the act, even if he committed this act, under California law, he may not be guilty of it. Why? Because then we get into mental health arguments. Did he understand what he was doing was murder at the time? All of that. It's another road to get down. We don't need to get down at this exact moment in time. That statement, though, left a trail of breadcrumbs. It pointed towards something the public was already whispering about, an insanity defense. But it also marked the moment when the financial and emotional lifeline from Nick's surviving siblings apparently went dark. Sources have reported that Jake and Romy may have stopped funding Jackson's legal fees at that moment in time, but would make sense. Beyond his control, Nick was reassigned to public defender Kimberly Green, a courthouse veteran with nearly two decades of experience in the family that had reportedly spent years trying to save Nick, funding rehab after rehab, absorbing crisis after crisis, drew a line. An insider quoted by Globe put it bluntly, to the surviving family members, Nick is Satan incarnate. They reportedly wanted nothing to do with him. And the prospect of a tell-all, according to that same insider, would pile agony on top of grief that hasn't even begun to settle. But here's what makes that tell-all reporting more than tabloid noise. It sits inside a much larger picture of Nick Reiner's reported mental state, one that multiple sources have described in terms that go well beyond anger or resentment. According to TMZ's documentary on the case, sources connected to the Reiner family say Nick knows what he did. He reportedly acknowledged the act himself, but he allegedly does not understand why he's in jail. Sources described him as delusional, believing that the people who put him behind bars are part of a conspiracy against him. this is common when you have someone that is mentally ill. It's not as clean cut as we'd like it to be. I mean, I don't know what's better. I mean, what is better? Honest to God, if you're Nick's family, if you're Nick, I mean, ask yourself that for a second. What's better here? Is it Nick Reiner being this? If in fact this isn't an act, if this in fact is him, he doesn't understand why he's in jail, even though he did this. There's something seriously wrong there. Does that make this easier to digest? Or is it easier to digest if you're just thinking he's an awful human being who does what he wants, when he wants, and drug-fueled, by choice, tantrums that he's had throughout his life? I don't know. I mean, I don't know if any of them are, none of them land great. And I guess you're kind of playing, you know, least worst of the worst, which is never really a fun game, and it never really ends well. Harvey Levin reported from jail sources described Nick as out of his head and almost childlike, unable to process the consequences of what he's been accused of. Other accounts describe him screaming his innocence at night and curling up during the day inside a facility that's been described in reports as plagued by mold, broken plumbing, and conditions no one would choose. That part I kind of like, actually. That's a shame. The reported root of that mental state traces back to a medication change. Nick was reportedly diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder in 2020, a condition the Mayo Clinic describes as a combination of schizophrenia symptoms, including hallucinations, delusions, alongside severe mood disorder symptoms. And again, all could be very true. He could, I know there's a lot of people like, he's just a horrible person. And like, yeah, sometimes horrible people are this. That's what makes them horrible people. Their brain does not work right. I mean, it's not, I'm not asking for grace. I'm just trying to, let's be sure we're, you know, operating on the same deck and talking about the same sort of things here and understanding them for what they are, not just pure emotion and our own rage of let's burn him. I get that. But if we want to get ahead of these people in the future, it's good to take a close look at what the recipe is that made these people and what's going on in their brains to identify it early. Not just horrible people, burn them at the stake. Like, yeah, we've done that for a long time. It doesn't really fix anything, though, does it? Things just keep getting worse. According to the TMZ documentary, doctors changed the medication he was taking for the condition roughly a month before the murders, after Nick reportedly complained about weight gain. That's a choice you probably want to take back. Sources say that change destabilized him. And according to the same sources, his medication still isn't working properly inside Twin Towers. None of that is offered as an excuse. It is offered as context, because the tell-all, if the reporting is accurate, doesn't emerge from a place of strategic calculation. It emerges from a mind that, according to multiple sourced accounts, cannot hold the reality of its own situation. So I'm sure a tell-all's really going to be telling sane reality, right? The man who reportedly cannot process why he's incarcerated wants to write a book explaining why his parents' life were taken by him. If I did it, seen that book already. That worked out well. A man described as almost childlike in his comprehension of consequences wants to control the narrative of a double homicide case that has captivated the country. That's not strategy. That is the illness still running the show, and the people around him are still paying the price for it. Which brings us back to Jake. Because Jake's essay doesn't just grieve. It reveals. When you hold it up against what Nick is reportedly doing from his cell, I mean, that contrast isn't just emotional. It's structural. It tells you everything about who these men are and what they took from the same family. Jake wrote about the night of December 14th. He was at Union Station attending a celebration of life for a close friend who had recently passed. His sister, Romy, called. Their father was dead. Minutes later, she called again. Their mother was dead. Jake described the 45-minute Lyft ride from downtown Los Angeles to the family home in Brentwood as unendurable. His world, as he knew it, had collapsed. He was in a trance. The only thing he could focus on was getting to his childhood home, getting to his sister, figuring out what had just happened. He wrote about his parents as his guiding lights. He called his mother his confidant, something or someone he could talk to for hours when life got complicated. He called his father his hero and said he felt he could come to him with anything. He wrote about watching Dodgers games with his dad, about seeing Les Miserables with his mom, about experiences he knows most people never get because of who his parents were. And then he wrote the line that lands hardest. He would trade every Dodger game, every Broadway show, every vacation if he could spend one more hour talking to them and saying goodbye. That's who Rob and Michelle Reiner were to the son who survived them. Guiding lights, confidants, heroes, the foundation of who he is as a human being. And the reported tell-all, the one their other son allegedly wants to write, it would take those same people, the parents who funded treatment after treatment, who made a film about his addiction alongside him, who let him live in the guest house on their property, who brought him to a holiday party the night before they were allegedly killed, and recast them as villains with sordid secrets, not because they wronged him, not because they abandoned him, but because, according to sources, he's furious that the people still alive have finally stopped orbiting his destruction. If you know anything about narcissists or borderlines or psychopaths or sociopaths, this is what they do. It's like they all go to the same convention and go, when everyone finally abandons you, here's how to get them back. Here's how to try and destroy their world. I go, it's a great idea. Rob and Michelle Reiner didn't abandon Nick. By every available account, they were the opposite of absent. They poured resources into his recovery for years. They brought him into their professional world. They kept him close, literally on their property. And according to the accounts that have emerged since their deaths, Michelle had grown increasingly concerned about his mental health in the weeks leading up to December 14th. They weren't parents who looked away. They were parents who looked directly at the problem over and over and kept trying. And they had a million reasons to not, but they did. The tell-all, if it materializes, would attempt to rewrite that. And that's what makes it so revealing, not as a publishing event, but as a psychological one. Nick Reiner's reported desire to expose his parents' secrets isn't the act of someone seeking justice or clarity. It's the act of someone who, according to the people closest to the situation, has spent a lifetime reframing the people trying to help him as the people causing his pain. This tell-all isn't a new behavior. It's allegedly the same behavior, just with a manuscript instead of a manipulated conversation. Jake seems to understand that. His essay doesn't mention Nick by name in the context of blame. He refers to having his brother at the center of it and calls it almost too impossible to process. He doesn't rage. He doesn't accuse. He asks for love and compassion, the same principles he writes that his parents lived by. And he closes by acknowledging what everyone around him already knows, that for the people inside this tragedy, it's not something that fades with time. It's every single day. The legal reality continues to unfold. Nick faces two counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances that make the case eligible for death penalty or life without parole. The DA's office is still weighing whether to pursue execution, with prosecutors reportedly invited to hear arguments from the defense. A hearing approaching in Los Angeles will set the timeline for a preliminary hearing, though the DA has signaled that the volume of discovery, a pending coroner's report, and potential expert testimony requests will likely push the timeline further out. An insanity defense remains a very strong possibility given the documented history of schizoaffective disorder and the medication change that multiple sources have cited as a destabilizing event. It could also be all performance. Think of that too. We don't know. I'm not saying I know, but this is a man who knows how to manipulate. And what better way to look crazy than writing a crazy tell-all book that's not remotely based in reality? Look at this writing. He's clearly out of his mind. He's insane. That's what we're going to plead. Seems like a logical strategy to me if I were a defense attorney. Have him write the book. That'll help you with your insanity defense. But is he really insane, or is it all manipulation? Say a bunch of crazy shit, and then boom. That's the problem with people like this, people who some days probably are not operating with a full set of cards. And other days they are. The thing is, both days, the same engine is running, the same engine of manipulation. The same engine of cognitive dissonance from reality. The same engine that really looks very similar depending on what day you're looking at. Very different from the inside as to if he's operating on facts and reality or if he's operating on greed and arrogance and selfishness and all of that. Manipulation. Gaslighting. Sometimes if that's just your mode, that's all you know how to do, you don't even know you're doing it. That's just how people operate, right? That's how some operate. It's now the rest of the world's job here, more specifically, jury eventually, and the DA in Los Angeles to determine what the hell actually is going on here. The legal process, however it plays out, won't resolve the human damage that's already been done. And the reported tell-all, whether it ever reaches a publisher or dies as a scribbled note in a jail cell, has already accomplished something. It has shown, according to those who've reported on it, that the pattern hasn't changed, even from inside a correctional facility, even facing the most serious charges the state of California can bring, even after allegedly taking the lives of the two people who tried hardest to save him. Families who love someone dangerous spend years being the only barrier between that person and total collapse. They absorb the chaos. They fund the recovery. They make excuses, set boundaries, reset boundaries, and absorb more chaos. And when those families finally step back or are taken away, the person left behind doesn't sit with it. They don't reflect. They retaliate. Not because the family failed them, but because the family was the last thing standing between them and the version of reality they've constructed. And without that buffer, the only move left is to burn the record. Nick Reiner's reported tell-all is in a book. It's allegedly the last attempt to manipulate people who can no longer be manipulated. And Jake Reiner's essay, Raw, Restrained Human, is proof that the people who actually loved Rob and Michelle don't need a tell-all to honor them. They just need the truth to tell. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. Is Nick Reiner in that cell right now? Is this all a manipulation play? Let's look as crazy as possible. Or is it genuine? Is he just that far gone? I don't know the answer to that question. I'm curious to get your thoughts on where you stand. We'll continue that conversation there in the comments. Substack and YouTube are the best places to do it. Links are in the description. All right? I will see you there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching this as we, of course, continue to bring you the latest on this and many stories here at the Hidden Killers podcast. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.